Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. Let me apologize in advance that I have a bit of a cold, so my voice might not carry. Hopefully you can hear me with the speaker. This is joint work with John Smiley. I want to repeat or emphasize something about the philosophy of this work that was also mentioned by John, that there are many aspects of the study of quadratic differentials which use a lot of sophisticated machinery from various mathematical disciplines, and one of the features of this is that we try to prove things in very elementary ways. And so part of the work which I will discuss, part of the theorems which I'll describe, can be proved by other methods. Our methods are very, very low tech, and this has two advantages. First advantage is that we are, you know, we're able to understand the proof. And for some people, that's not they don't feel any lack of understanding when they're using very difficult results. I think we're able to understand the proofs better to some extent, and also it enables one to get some effectiveness from the proofs. Okay, so this is a slide. Everything on this slide has already been defined. I guess I should just tell you my notation. So we're looking at quadratic differentials. The singularity set, so Q is a generic letter for a quadratic differential, and its singularity set is denoted by sigma sub Q, and vector K is the vector recording the multiplicities of the zeros. I'm assuming that these zeros are ordered in some way. And the Veitch group I denote by gamma sub Q. That's on the bottom of the slide. Okay. And I'll just draw. So these, as everybody already knows, these come up in various contexts. And I'll draw some pictures. So one of the ways of constructing these quadratic differentials or translation surfaces is via polygonal billiards. So let me draw two pictures corresponding to billiards in two polygons. The first picture was already drawn by in Anton's talk. So if you start with a square, let me just first go through this definition of this construction. This is in the billiards world, this is sometimes called the universal surface construction, except it's a general construction which works for arbitrary polygonal billiard, but in the case of a table with rational angles, it will give you a flat surface, and in the case of a table with irrational angles, it'll give you some other object, more complicated object, two-dimensional. And add an additional dimension. Here's the construction. We take the polygon, which is denoted here by P, and we take the the group that's generated by reflections in the sides of the polygon, and we take that's a finite group if our polygon has rational angles, and we take the polygon and we move it around. So we look at the disjoint union of the images of this polygon under these elements of this dihedral group, and then we glue them as Anton described. So if we take our square, then this dihedral group has four elements, and we get four copies of the square. Well, why don't I glue them in already? So we get four copies of this square glued to each other, and in this case we just get a bigger square, and this bigger square has the opposite ends identified, so we get a regular standard torus. And of course, the reason that this construction is of interest for people studying billiards is because if you start off in the original table in some direction and reflect, then in the associated flat surface, you don't reflect, you keep going along in the straight lines as Anton described. And if you choose your initial direction to be sufficiently generic, in other words, not having any stabilizer in this finite group, then these copies can be identified with the images of this particular vector, so you can sort of, so for example, this is the original direction, and here we go, I mean, this direction I would think of as associated with this polygon because in the original polygon, when I pass to this, the corresponding reflection moves the vector in this direction, and so I have this picture, and I get a torus. More complicated polygon is the certain right triangle with the property that as you do this unfolding construction, you basically get, let me try to do this fairly precisely, you get an example which was discussed several times, namely the double pentagon example. So you get 20 copies of your original right triangle, and you get two pentagons with opposite sides identified, with parallel sides identified, and we get a surface of genus 2 with the, I think this was worked out that this, all these sides, all these vertices get identified, and we have a surface in H2 in this case. Okay, so those pictures are going to be useful for later. So our stratum is obtained by fixing this singularity data. And I'll denote strata by this calligraphic M. And we normalize the area. And so you can think of the stratum as parameterizing certain constructions of surfaces out of pieces of graph paper. And graph paper here means that, you know, you think of paper with little squares on it, and all the gluing maps preserve this notion of little squares. So you have this, all this was described already. And the nice thing about strata, and I think Anton and John Smiley alluded to this, but I think I want to emphasize this point. The nice thing about the strata point of view is that everything about it is very, very elementary. I mean, the describing the, so Anton in his, I think his first lecture described the topology on this, on these strata, and it's sort of a very, very obvious topology. On the other hand, these strata fit together, different strata corresponding to surfaces of the same genus but with different singularity patterns fit together in some complicated way and form what's known as a quadratic differential space of a given surface of a fixed genus. And that's a more complicated object. The topology on it is more complicated to define, and we get some of the complications that came up, for example, in Howie Mazur's talk of what happens, or in several talks, I guess, of what happens when we degenerate from one stratum to another, and how these strata glue to each other. Okay, each stratum has the obvious SL2R action on it, and again, the Veitch group can be described in the terms of the SL2R action as a stabilizer at the corresponding point. Typically, this Veitch group is a trivial group, and a typical orbit is dense in the connected component of the stratum. And as John Smiley pointed out, one is often very interested in exceptional Qs. Exceptional Qs means Qs for which the stabilizer group might not be trivial and or the orbit might not be dense. So this is the kinds of things that one is interested in. And sort of the first big question that one might ask about these groups is which groups actually show up. So what Fuchsian groups, in general, all we know is this is a discrete subgroup of SL2R. First question would be which groups actually show up. Second question would be to put some kind of classification on. The word classification here, well, as we'll see, doesn't really make a lot of sense. There's really, I mean, I'll try to say in a few minutes why this is kind of a hopeless question in some sense. What do you expect from the classification of all these groups? But at least you want to organize this infinite set of groups in some reasonable way to begin to have a handle on figuring out which groups arise and what properties they have. Another thing you want to do, given a flat structure, is to relate the dynamical properties of two associated dynamical systems with the group structure or structure of various elements in the group. Namely, you have the dynamics on the stratum of the SL2R action, and you have the dynamics of the billiards or the geodesic flow on the associated flat surface. So you want to relate that to group theoretic properties. And now there's only, I think, two relatively easy, well-known restrictions on these groups. First of all, these groups are never co-compact. And the reason is simple. You just take any stabilizer group. If it were co-compact, that would mean that the SL2R action has to remain in a compact part of the moduli space. But since you can always take a saddle connection and pinch it using your SL2R action, you have to leave compact subsets of your stratum. So these groups can never be co-compact. And the other restriction is an arithmetic restriction, which John alluded to. So there's the results of Goodkin and Judge, Kennan and Smiley, giving some arithmetic restrictions. In particular, any Veitch group can be conjugated into the K points of SL2R, where K is the number field of degree at most G. And there's some tiny bit of additional information, which I'm not going to go into. So these are the restrictions which are known, and then there's a list of things which can be constructed. So let me go over the elements in this list and say a little bit more about each. Before talking about groups, I guess one should talk about elements in such groups. So first, easiest type of elements to understand are the parabolic elements. So parabolic element is a element of SL2R conjugate to a matrix of the form so if P is conjugate to one of these matrices, it's a parabolic element, of course. And, well, first of all, one can construct Veitch groups which are cyclic parabolic groups easily enough. And the way to do that is to realize that these elements correspond precisely to cylinder decompositions on the surface with a commensurable moduli. So let me describe that a little bit. I guess this has also appeared in several talks, but not very carefully. So if you take either of these two examples, I guess the easier one to start with is on the torus. Take the matrix, precisely the matrix that I've written out on the other board, 1101, apply it to this polygon, and you will get you get a parallelogram, and now you can re-glue by topologically affecting a Dane twist on the surface. You can basically take this triangle and put it back here, and this is a homeomorphism of the surface, and it affects the Dane twist on our surface, and so we get direction, of course, is a cylinder direction, so we're affecting a Dane twist around a circle, around a cylinder. And in general, for example, in this example, you might have several cylinders, and for each of those cylinders, the modulus, so what was important here is that this vertex was moved by the unipotent matrix so that it hit this corner. So if you have two or three or some number of cylinders, what you want to do is have a... of course, I could equally well have taken this vertex into this point. So I could have a more general, more degenerate parallelogram, and then I would... That would correspond to two or three or more Dane twists around my cylinder. So if your moduli are commensurable, which means that they're rational multiples of each other, if you have several different cylinders whose moduli are commensurable, then you can find a common matrix, a parabolic matrix, which will make all these cylinders, all these rectangles into parallelograms, and then you could rearrange them all simultaneously so you get an element of your stabilizer group. So let me try and draw, I'm not too good at drawing pictures, but let me try to draw a more complicated example in this double pentagon. So here is our double pentagon. And we can consider these two triangles and two trapezoids and rearrange the picture according to the gluing. So I take this trapezoid over here and I get this parallelogram. And now I take this triangle and move it over here and I get a different parallelogram. Pardon? This is a triangle. Oh, I'm sorry. So this trapezoid moved over here. Now we have one parallelogram, and this triangle moved over here. We have another parallelogram. And you can do a calculation involving the fact that this is a regular pentagon. You can do a calculation that will show you that the modulus of this parallelogram, which is the ratio of the height to the width, is the same as the modulus of this parallelogram. So what that means is if you take an SL2R element of the form over on that right board over there, left board over there, except with the one replaced by a number, a certain number, it'll be the number exactly, if we fix this vertex, it'll be the number moving this point to this point. So this this parallelogram will shear to form this parallelogram. And with the very same matrix, this parallelogram, if we fix now this point as being the identity, will shear to this parallelogram. So this means that when you have commensurable moduli, the cylinder decomposition gives you a parabolic element, and then it's not too difficult to prove, this was shown by Veach, that this is an if and only if condition. So that means the parabolic elements of the stabilizer group correspond in one-to-one fashion to cylinder decompositions, where the direction, I should say, every parabolic element has an axis, which is the direction of the unique eigenvector of the parabolic element, and the cylinder decompositions are in the direction of the of that axis of the parabolic element. I'm saying that any parabolic element of any Veach group corresponds precisely to a cylinder decomposition of the given surface whose direction is the eigenvalue of the eigenvector of the parabolic element, and cylinders need to have commensurable moduli. When you have commensurable moduli, there's a notion of the least common multiple of the moduli, and this multiple, so each, you get the number of Dane twists around each corresponding cylinder can be expressed by this data. So now if you want to try and construct a surface with a cyclic Veach group and only a cyclic Veach group, what you do is you take this, you take such a construction, you force there to be a parabolic element, and then you perturb it preserving this condition. So you start fiddling, you can take this double pentagon, this regular double pentagon around, you can make some perturbations of it which preserve this parabolic automorphism, and they're going to destroy anything else. So you can do this in genus 2. More complicated are hyperbolic elements. There are two constructions that I'm aware of constructing hyperbolic elements. I guess this was mentioned in John's talk. So a hyperbolic element, as John described, is one conjugate to a diagonalizable element. The lambda here, the bigger eigenvalue, I'll just denote by lambda of h, where h is my hyperbolic element. And these correspond to, so first of all, there are two two different constructions of surfaces with hyperbolic elements in their Veach group. And these are one is a construction of Thurston, which I call the Bouillabaisse construction, which is, I hope, will become a standard terminology. This construction was explained in great detail at Bouillabaisse Night in Lumini a few years ago. So, you know, Thurston has many contributions, and as you saw in John's talk, one of the ongoing themes is to try to find nice, suggestive terminology. I think people working in the field remember this construction due to this very memorable talk by John Hubbard. So the Bouillabaisse construction is a construction by Thurston in which some people, I guess, call this the independent multi-twist constructions. So what you do, let me just explain this very briefly. You actually find two non-commuting parabolic elements. When you have two non-commuting parabolic elements in your stabilized group, you can take a product of them, and generically you get a hyperbolic element. Or, you know, take their commutator, and it's going to be a hyperbolic element. That means your surface, whenever you do this construction, your surface comes with a hyperbolic element or pseudo-Anosov, but it also has additional parabolic elements in the stabilizer group. An example here, you know, you could start with this double pentagon example. Everything that I did showing that there's a parabolic element in this direction, in the horizontal direction, can be done after rotating by the rotational symmetry here. I can get an additional parabolic element in another direction, and then I can use these two elements to generate a hyperbolic element. This is the Bouillabaisse construction of Thurston. I'll have more to say about it later. And there's an additional construction by Arnoux and Yocoz, which, frankly, I don't completely understand. So they construct hyperbolic elements in a different way. An open problem in the field, famous kind of embarrassing open question, is whether or not you can have Veach group, which is cyclic and hyperbolic. Cyclic group generated by hyperbolic elements. Now, when you have a hyperbolic element from, I guess this is also due to Thurston, or maybe not, I'm not so sure, but you have Markov partitions. So I guess I won't attempt to draw these Markov partitions. What they are rectangles or parallelograms on your surface whose directions, whose sides are in the directions of the stable and unstable leaves for the pseudo-Anosov, and they partition the surface into rectangles or parallelograms, which have the very nice property of being a Markov partition. Namely, when you apply the pseudo-Anosov, they get, if they were tall and thin, they become short and wide, and then they wind around your surface. And the property is that if the image of one of these parallelograms intersects a parallelogram from the So if you take one PI and apply the pseudo-Anosov to it and intersect it with PJ, as soon as this intersection is non-empty, the intersection goes completely through PJ. So it doesn't stop inside PJ. So it's a standard Markov picture. Okay. Now I guess these rest of these slides, I won't have so much to say about the examples. There are arithmetic lattices and non-arithmetic lattices, non-arithmetic in the technical terminology, as John pointed out, these lattices do seem to have some arithmetic associated with them, but they're not arithmetic in the usual sense of the word. They're not commensurable to SLTZ. This was constructed by Veach. This double pentagon example is exactly Veach's, I guess, first example of a non-arithmetic lattice. You do get infinitely generated Fuchsian groups of the first kind. First kind means that the limit points are the entire circle at infinity, boundary of the hyperbolic plane. And there are two constructions of this originally, one due to Hubert and Schmidt and another due to McMullen. I'll have more to say about the Hubert-Schmidt construction later on. What I want to emphasize is that as soon as these groups, as soon as you see that there are infinitely generated groups in your list, the whole classification problem becomes kind of strange. I mean, you're not going to start writing generators and relations for all of the Veach groups if one of them is not even infinitely generated. Then there's a nice paper of recent paper of Hubert and Lanoe, in which they construct a Veach group that only has, that doesn't have parabolics, and their construction, they analyze the Arnoux-Yocca's construction of hyperbolics, and they also analyze the Bouillabaisse construction, and they realize that the Bouillabaisse construction forces the holonomy field, which was previously defined, to be totally real. So you take the, if you take the Arnoux-Yocca's examples, the holonomy field turns out not to be totally real, and therefore there cannot be. And actually, they prove that whenever you do have parabolics, non-commuting parabolics, right, you have totally real holonomy field. And there's a recent existence result by Martin Moeller and Irene Bow, I don't know how to pronounce her name, showing that all for all triangle groups, there's a actually, I guess this should say, all triangle groups have come up as being commensurable to Veach groups, some cues. Okay, so this is a list of what is, I think, hopefully a complete list of what is known about existence. Now, what about classification? Well, how do you want to classify your groups? Well, the first thing you want to try to classify are the Veach, or the lattice groups, and there is a kind of restricted classification. If you're interested in those lattice groups coming from billiards in acute-angled rational triangles, then the full list is known due to Kenning and Smiley and Pukta. And it's, I think, we're relevant for this talk to mention that in the Kenyon Smiley paper, they actually come up with an effective algorithm for finding these guys. So finding the rational angled triangles are ordered in a natural way. You just take the angles of the sides by least common denominator. You have this very natural increasing subsequence of triangles, increasing sequence covering all the triangles. And so there's a natural ordering on the possible Veach group that might arise. And Kenyon Smiley developed an effective program that in finite time will tell you exactly, well, will find, I should be careful. So this Kenyon Smiley algorithm, given some large number n, will search through the entire list of candidates for lattices coming from rational angled, from the first n acute angled rational triangles. And it will go through this list and strike off, you know, 99.9% of that list as being groups which cannot be lattices. And then there was some additional work, so the remaining list was very short, and then there was some additional work to verify that what the program didn't cross out were actually rationally angled polygons. So, but I want to emphasize that there's some effectivity in their classification, in the sense that you could actually program a computer to find these things, and this was actually done, and this is part of the proof. So this is actually, this result depends on a computer search, you know, it's a combined result. Other classification results are the results described just previous lecture of Coulter and McMullen. They classified all the lattices that come up in genus 2. They also know that all the non-elementary Fuchsian groups which arise in the stratum H2 are actually lattices. So there are no strange groups coming up in the stratum H2. And in the stratum H11, you do get infinitely generated groups. However, all you can get are Fuchsian groups of the first kind, infinitely generated. In H11, either you get lattices. In fact, there's only very simple lattices, so there's a decagon and there are torus covers, and you get a slew of additional non-elementary Veach groups which are all infinitely generated of the first kind, which means they have the limit set of the entire boundary of the hyperbolic plane. That sort of describes what's known about the classification problems. And here are some associated dynamical properties. When you have, and I'll focus on lattice surfaces, when you stabilize a surface, there are two connections with the two dynamical systems which I mentioned. If you look at the associated flat surface and the geodesic flow on your flat surface, then there's a very nice result of Veach, which is the Veach dichotomy. Now I'm denoting by this script L theta the saddle connections in direction theta. Whenever you have a saddle connection in direction theta, Veach tells you that this direction comes with a parabolic element in that direction. So the Veach group contains a parabolic element which has that direction fixed. In other words, this direction gives you a cylinder decomposition of the surface into cylinders with commensurable moduli. If you don't have a saddle connection, says Veach, the associated flow is uniquely ergodic. So it's a complete dichotomy, two very simple dynamical alternatives, as was mentioned in several talks. Generically, this is very different from the general case. Generically, you should have almost every direction will be uniquely ergodic, but there will exist directions which are minimal but not uniquely ergodic. There will exist directions in which the saddle connections give you some kind of configuration, which is not a doesn't give you a cylinder decomposition. So this is a very strong property. And if you look at the side of the action on the moduli space, the lattice property, of course, says that the associated trajectory has finite volume, has a finite natural volume. And this turns out to be equivalent to the fact that the SL2R orbit is closed. So closed a priori weaker, so the direction going from being a lattice to being closed is relatively simple. I guess it's due to Veach. And the converse is trickier, and there are two independent proofs. One is due to Smiley, the other is due to joint work of mine with Yaryuminsky, and I'll describe this proof later because it turns out to be important for the rest of the talk. So I guess these slides up to now represent things which are known, and now the goal is to try to just find some kind of organizing principle to make nice, reasonable order out of this large number of examples. I guess that's the overriding theme here. So the first notion is the notion of triangle areas. So you have, given a flat structure, you define a triangle for that flat structure. A triangle is a triangle. It has vertices in the singularities, and it's isometrically embedded. And you'll notice, of course, that if you have a triangle for Q and you apply the affine action, you still get the shifted triangle is a triangle for the shifted structure. And then you can define the triangle area spectrum, which is the all possible areas of all possible triangles. And generically, you should have infinitely many triangles. So you should imagine a flat surface. It's going to have triangles on them, a lot of triangles which are going to be long and thin, winding around the surface in some way. And generically, you're going to have infinitely many possible triangles, and the infimum of their areas is going to be zero generically. Vorobetz introduced the no small triangles property. We denote this by NST of alpha. Alpha is a parameter, positive number, and NST of alpha denotes all the flat structures whose smallest triangle has area greater than or equal to alpha. And you know from this definition, it's immediate using topology, which was described by Anton. This immediately is G invariant, and it's immediately a closed condition. Right? If you have small triangles in the limit, as you approach this limit, you should have small triangles in the structure, because that's the nature of this topology. So there's a very obvious closed invariant set. Now you can consider the corresponding set of affine equivalence classes. We denote that by NST tilde of alpha, and the first theorem is that this is a finite list. So what I'm saying is, given a positive alpha, there's only a finite list of structures which don't have triangles smaller than alpha, and as you let alpha go to zero, you're going to get longer and longer lists which will cover all the surfaces which don't have which have a positive bound on their positive lower bound on their triangle areas. No, no, no. This is going to be important that I didn't fix the stratum here. It doesn't depend on the genus. Well, I mean, if you have this triangle bound, it will force something about the genus, because each triangle, it'll give you some bound on the complexity of the triangulation. Each triangle, the areas are normalized to be 1. So if you have this bound, there can only be 1 over alpha possible triangles in a triangulation, and therefore there's a bound on the genus. Okay. Now, the importance of this property is that it characterizes the lattice property. This is another theorem here. Following our equivalent, this was basically initiated by Vorobets, and so Vorobets proved many directions in this theorem. I won't go into the details, but you have the following equivalences. The lattice property is equivalent to having only finitely many triangle areas. In fact, it's equivalent to having only finitely many triangles at all up to the action of the stable of the Veitch group. This is equivalent to having a lower bound on the triangle areas, and this is also equivalent to something which we call the uniform Veitch dichotomy. Namely, remember the Veitch dichotomy. There were two possibilities. If you had saddle connections, the Veitch dichotomy said that this was a completely periodic direction, and here we're saying that if there is a uniform number R, such that if you have a saddle connection, then all the segments in that direction have lengths whose ratios are bounded by R. So you can't have simultaneously short and long segments in the same direction. Okay? This is the uniform, just kind of a uniform strengthening of each dichotomy. Okay, so the theorem says, so in particular, the previous result told you that the set NST of alpha is finite, and this result is telling you that NST of alpha is equivalent to the lattice property, so it's providing you with a natural way to list the lattice examples, right? This parameter alpha, as you let it go to zero, is going to produce a list of all the lattice examples. Another theorem here is that actually the regular Veitch dichotomy, which I mentioned earlier, is not necessary and sufficient for the lattice property. Namely, there do exist flat structures which satisfy the Veitch dichotomy. I'll say more about that later. Which satisfy the Veitch dichotomy, but for which the stabilizer group is not a lattice. The Veitch group is not a lattice. And another kind of interesting remark is that when you replace triangles with other configurations like quadrilaterals or pentagons or convex pentagons or pairs of disjoint convex triangles or any such configuration, you automatically define a closed univariate set. So you might guess, given this, you might sort of hope, given the previous result, that these are all always give you the lattice examples. But we can show that if you do replace triangles with pentagons, it doesn't characterize the lattice property. So you can actually find examples which don't have the lattice property and have a bound on the areas of pentagons. So much for the triangles property. Here's another way of organizing elements or groups. I'm going to organize groups by cusp areas. So let's suppose we have a parabolic element in our stabilizer, and we have a non-elementary Veitch group. And what I'm going to this gives you two pieces of information. One, you have what I denote by K of P is the number of cylinders in the associated decomposition. So in this example, the number of cylinders was 2, say. The number of cylinders in the associated decomposition and the area of the associated cusp. So what is the area of the associated cusp? Well, this is a non-elementary Fuchsian group. So the parabolic element gives you, so if you take H, upper half plane, mod gamma Q, what you're going to be seeing is some surface, not necessarily finite volume, so it could look like this. Something like that, say. Each cusp here has an area. So what is that area? So So you take this, for example, this cusp, and you take horocyclic loops around that, and at some point, these... not a very good picture. At some point, these loops stop being... As I push the... I'm pushing a horocycle. If I push the horocycle up, of course, it gets shorter and shorter and goes off into the cusp. If I shoot the horocycle down, it'll stop being injectively embedded at some point. That's due to the fact that the group is non-elementary. So at some point, I'm going to get kind of a well-defined end to this cusp, and I can now measure the area according to the, hyperbolic metric, and I get a number. And so this is, I gave you a formal definition on the slide. And the set of flat structures, sorry, the set, the no large cusps set is a set of pairs. Q is a flat structure, P is a parabolic element. I'm assuming that gamma Q is non-elementary. And I fix the number of cylinders in the associated associated decomposition, and I fix, and I give an upper bound on the areas of the cusps. And as before, the tilde denotes the fact that we're quotienting out by the affine equivalence relation, and the theorem says that this gives you a finite list. So there's only finitely many pairs which have small cusps, relatively small cusps. So there are two ways of measuring the complexity of this cusp. One is the area, the other is the number of cylinders in the decomposition. If you bound the complexity, you only have finitely many of these guys. Here's another kind of result for pseudo-Nassau's. Given a pseudo-Nassau, you have two numbers associated with it. One is the larger eigenvalue of the hyperbolic matrix, and another is the number of parallelograms in a Markov partition. The Markov partition is not uniquely defined, but I can take the smallest possible number in a Markov partition. So I'm calling that L of Q and H. And NSMP, NSMP stands for no simple Markov partitions. I guess it should say simple Markov partitions. So fixing the parameters L and T, I want all flat structures with a hyperbolic element in their stabilizer, so I'm counting those pairs. And I want these pairs to correspond to having simple Markov partitions. So Markov partition is simple in the sense that this eigenvalue, this dilatation of the corresponding pseudo-Nassau, and the complexity of the geometry of the Markov partition are both bounded, and that's a finite number up to the action of the up to the SL2R action. Let me mention two applications of these results. So I guess the main point here is that I think somehow that the applications are interesting, but I think I'll have more to say towards the end about why I like these results, and I'll say the proofs are not extremely difficult, and I'll go through some ideas. But so here are some. I'll give you some applications, but later I'll tell you why these results are helpful in kind of organizing the things that you want to look for. Or search for in some sense. Okay, so one type of application is related to the previous question by Sasha Profetov. What happens if you fix a stratum and look for things in a stratum? So you get that the number of lattice example in a fixed stratum where the covolume of the Veitch group is less than some number t, that's a finite number. McLuhan has an independent proof of that, which is unpublished, using some algebraic geometry. I'll show you some ideas of this proof. It's very elementary, and it gives explicit bounds in some sense. Another application would be to reprove a famous result of Veitch. Namely, you look at the hyperbolic elements in a given stratum. So that just corresponds to the number of periodic orbits of a given period, periodic for the Teichmuller geodesic flow. That number is bounded, and Veitch actually got some bounds on the growth of that number as a function of the dilatation factor lambda of H. So Veitch's proof is very explicit. I should repeat my previous remark in answer to Sasha Bufetov's question. These are just corollaries. Our bounds, our finiteness result is independent of the stratum. We don't assume that we're in a fixed stratum. And another type of result is to give another restriction on the possible Veitch groups. So a Veitch group can't have infinitely, because there's only finitely many cusps all over, you know, all over the flat surface world with a fixed covolume, or at least inside your stratum, then a fixed Q, the corresponding stabilizer group can't have infinitely many cusps of the same volume. Similarly, a fixed Veitch group can't have infinitely many hyperbolic elements of without the dilatation factors going to infinity. So if you so an example of this, if you take a normal subgroup of infinite index in a lattice in SL2R, this cannot occur as a Veitch group. So here's another type of group which cannot come up. Okay, how do prove these results? I guess I've singled out. I'm not going to prove any one of these theorems. I've singled out some ideas. How am I doing on time, Anton? So, okay, I didn't realize this was the case. So I'll just give you some of the ideas very quickly. So, the Perron-Frobenius matrices comes up in three different places. We have the Perron-Frobenius trick for Markov partitions, which is due to, I guess, Thurston. We have a Perron-Frobenius trick for pairs of non-commuting cylinder decompositions, which is actually... So this was used in some form by Thurston and later in a different form by Veitch. And I gave the details here, but I won't have time to go into it. The point is that when you have this Bouillabaisse construction, you have two non-commuting parabolic elements, and you know the Dehn twists, you can form a kind of positive integer matrix which tells you something about the flat surface, records something about the flat surface, about these two cylinder decompositions. Similarly, for this cusp picture, as soon as you have this cusp ending, you can form a kind of a cylinder decomposition, and it has a certain symmetry, and you get two non-commuting cylinder decompositions. So in all three cases, you get some matrices, and you can do Perron-Frobenius. So they have Perron-Frobenius. The matrices have a unique eigenvector. You can relate this unique eigenvector to the geometry of the flat surface. So I'll just, without going into details, the corollary of these ideas would be that the combinatorics, if you know the combinatorics of either of those three objects, you know the flat structure up to SL2R, up to the action of SL2R. Idea number two, we use this to get isolation results. So an isolation result says that if you have a sequence of quadratic differentials tending to another quadratic differential in the stratum, and without reading this slide, it just means that all those combinatorial objects that I defined earlier are all bounded in some sense, stay bounded, then actually the limit guy and the limit, the things tending to the limit and the guy in the limit are in the same G orbit. So this is an isolation result in the sense that you can't, if you have a pseudo-Nosov in your stabilizer and you converge to something else, then actually, and that something else also has a pseudo-Nosov in its stabilizer, and these two pseudo-Nosovs have a bound on the dilatation length, then actually you cannot do this in a non-trivial way. Okay? So this is an isolation result. The last thing is this statement that I put up earlier without explaining, that the having a closed G orbit is sufficient for having the lattice property, and that uses, the proof of that goes through some, my proof, there are two, as I said, there are two proofs of this. One is joint work with Yuminsky, and the other is proof by John. Our proof goes through non-divergence estimates for the Horacycle flow. So if you know that the Hoyle cycle flow doesn't have divergent trajectories in a certain technical sense, a quantitative sense, then you know that you can prove that any G-invariant ergodic locally finite measure is actually finite. So this is a much more general statement, and this easily implies that a closed G-orbit has to be finite volume, because if it's closed, you can put a natural measure on it, which will be locally finite. So I apologize to Anton. I'll just put up some possible directions that this work raises for you to look at. One is the question of explicit bounds in these finite numbers. So we do get some kind of explicit bounds, and the question is, are they effective? The other is the question of effective searches. All of our arguments are very, very effective, and they can be used to start an effect. Say you want to search for all cusps in all flat surfaces of a given area. You know that that's a finite list. You also have an explicit way of carrying out that search, and it involves matrices, positive integer matrices, and analyzing their eigenvectors. You can also ask about the bottom of the spectrum, meaning which flat structures have the largest triangles, etc. And you can also talk about other configurations like pentagons or quadrilaterals with a bound on their area. So thank you for listening. That's it. Yeah, the example we take. Okay, so I should make a technical remark before giving you the proof. The statement is there exists a flat structure satisfying the following dichotomy: any direction containing a saddle connection is completely periodic, not necessarily. So you have a symmetry decomposition, but we don't assume that the moduli are commensurably related, and the other directions are uniquely ergodic. So Huber and Schmidt have examples with these irrational aperiodic connection points. In their examples, you get the same dichotomy, except the uniquely ergodic, replacing the word uniquely ergodic with minimal. So any direction not containing a saddle connection may prove is minimal. So the goal is to go from minimal to uniquely ergodic. And the way we do that is, so the examples are, take all the Huber-Schmidt examples where you branch over one point only. If you branch over one point only, the map from the covering, from this quadratic differential space containing the covering space to the quadratic differential space at the bottom is a proper map, because the fiber consists of choosing one point on a surface rather than two points. Two points on a surface, they could collide. One point, that's a proper map. If that's a proper map, now you apply Mayser. If you have minimal but non-uniquely ergodic, then you have to diverge. If you diverge upstairs and the map is proper, you also diverge down. That's the proof. And actually, I should point out that this proof uses, and we couldn't sort of get rid of it, it's a non-elementary proof in the sense that it uses the full strength of Howie Mayser's condition. We really need to look at the topology on the quadratic differential space rather than the topology on the strata.